Welcome to a study of the Book of Ephesians. Our speaker, Dr. Ken Boa, is president of Reflections Ministries and Trinity House Publishers. Today, he takes us to Ephesians chapter 5. Here's Dr. Ken Boa.
Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. Those two verses that open Ephesians chapter 5 are pregnant with meaning insofar as they tell us that God himself is the ultimate exemplar and that he is the model. Example is always more effective than teaching, wrote Samuel Johnson, and he's right. It is, in fact, through incarnation, it is through modeling that ultimately we learn real truth because it's lived truth. And people need to see truth not just in the abstract, they need to see it concretized. They need to see it actually realized through the flesh and blood of a possessor of truth, who is possessed by truth and then who proclaims it with credibility and dignity precisely because he has the moral credentials to do that. In other words, the more we have in our lives a congruence between our claims to truth and the way in which we live it, the more moral authority and integrity we have, and the more ultimately we can have as an influence on other people by virtue of modeling. Not even always with our words, but with our works, and that our lips and our lives are congruent. And the ultimate exemplar of that was Jesus himself, whose words and whose works were perfectly overlapped. And so this is just a way of looking at this world and seeing it in that regard. It's a powerful way of seeing what truth is like. I'll never forget the words my father once told me. I can tell you where I was standing and what was there. I just burned into my memory. He said, when he was angry with me, he says, "Do as I say and not as I do." I never forgot that. And that was really, I said, even then as a kid, I said, something's wrong with that. You know, I was a tyke, but even then I could know that wasn't right. And I know what he meant. I know what he wanted, but it wasn't quite the same thing. And that kind of burned in my memory, because is it possible that we are living that way? Do as I say and not as I do. Is it possible, for example, that a minister of the gospel, a person who claims to be a Christian in the workplace, a person who is a husband or a son, is it possible for such a person to do as I say but not as I do? You see, not articulating that, but acting that way. And of course, it is possible. Therein lies the question of credibility and of integrity. We want to be people who have a wholeness in this area. Now, again, I believe that the spiritual life then is more caught than taught. And I think that what we see in the whole image of all that Jesus did for us, all these beautiful images that we read from the Gospels, we can see that, and I've often said this to you, that Jesus never asks us to do something that he has not already first done for us. This is a very important principle. It's not just he's saying in the abstract, but just as I loved you, so also love one another. Just as I forgave you, so you must forgive one another. Just as I served you, you must serve one another. Just as I washed your feet, you must wash one another's feet. And on and on. And so we have in the gospel then an extraordinary image of incarnational truth. And that's really what Christianity is at the end of the day. It is incarnational. It is very real. It's not merely abstract. It puts the two together in a very real and palpable way whereby the Son of God became the Son of Man so that the sons of men could become sons of God, that great phrase by C.S. Lewis, and that he became one of us. And in his solidarity with the human condition, takes upon himself the full freight of human needs and of aspirations and so forth, and is the one person to live this life as such with perfection, the only one who could ultimately fulfill the law in all of its details and all of its aspects. And again, the genius of this is that the one who perfectly fulfilled the law now dwells in us. If we receive him, this gift of eternal life, as many as received him, which means to entrust themselves to him, to transfer your trust from yourselves, which is what religion's all about, and to transfer that trust to him exclusively. Once having received him, then, he grants us his indwelling life and now invites us to allow that life not only to abide in us, but to bear fruit through us. So that that life, then, is brought into fruition in a literal sense, but it's done that way in a unique way through the personality of the person who bears Christ. So you're a Christ bearer, as it were. And he wants to live his life through you as you, not as someone else. We're never called to be another person. It's kind of not good when we are comparing ourselves to another person, or they say to of this person, oh, he's another this, whatever that person is, whether it's good or bad. Really, he's not another that. He's unique, and he's not intended to be anyone but himself, but he is intended by God to become the fullness of what God created him to be. That's why the gospel has well been described as God's offer of his power to transform us into the people he always intended us to be. We don't have that power. You cannot become the person God intended you to be, not on your own. You can only become that person as you allow that power to be manifested in you and through you as you. And I think this is a very incredibly unique and important set of principles. Now, he says then, going back to our text, be imitators of God as beloved children and walk in love. And then he says, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. So he says, I want you to walk in love just as he did for you. And just as he gave himself up for you, Paul exhorts his readers, we are called to give our lives in exchange for others in a very real way. So that the life well lived is a life that's lived in exchange for other people, because other people are eternal beings. And consequently, a life well lived is a life that pursues God's value system and not the world's, the eternal value system of relationships rather than position, possession, and power and performance. Those things will all go away. They're transitory, they're fleeting. None of them will endure, and none of them will satisfy. The only thing that really satisfies in the life well lived is a life of relational richness. And when we pursue relational wealth, even though we might not have much by way of what the world defines as wealth, that's totally irrelevant. You want to pursue what God defines as wealth, not what the world defines as wealth. A life well lived, then, is a life given in exchange for that which God declares to be important. And by the way, you have no option. You will give your life in exchange for something. You have no choice. You will give your life in exchange for something. Just make sure it's something that God says is worthwhile. So here we have this beautiful picture then, where we, as imitators of him, are called to live a life of love. And the idea, just as Christ loved you, and then what does it go on to say? What's the next word? Just walk in love as Christ also loved you, and then what does it say? Gave. Key word, give. God is a giver. Biblical love is a giving love. It is not merely a love in thought and word, but a love in action and in deed. This is why that brings to mind 1 John chapter 3, when he says that, let me find that a little bit, verse 18 of John, 1 John 3. Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth. We shall know by this that we are of the truth and will assure our heart before him. In other words, let's put shoe leather to this and let's make it real, not abstract, not just words of love, but the deeds of love the choices of love. Because biblical love is a choice. I've often defined this for you as the steady intention of your will toward another's highest good. That agape love, then, is a volitional love, a love that chooses what's best for the beloved. And in doing so, then, we're considering the welfare of another person above our own. How is this possible for you to choose another and their welfare and to sacrifice yourself in some various ways to serve another man? And the way in which that's possible is when you realize that you already are full and that your needs have been fully provided. That you have nothing to prove, no one to impress, because you know who and whose you are. That because God's the one who's granted you unconditional love and acceptance. He is the one who has granted you true significance as being part of something that will endure. He is the one who has called you to accomplish something that will last forever. The more you grow into an apprehension experientially of those realities, and that's a process, not an event, the more then you become full and approach relationships out of the overflow of Christ in you, rather than approaching relationships with a deficiency mode. You see the difference? It's radical. There are many people who have need loves. And even when they love it, they need to be loved, you see. And so it's a conditional sort of love. It's a distorted form of love. The book to read along these lines is C.S. Lewis's classic, The Four Loves. And he describes each of the human loves and how, left to themselves, they become distorted loves and actually can even create their own unique forms of hatred unless they are brought up into the agape of God and become divine human loves. And so that the God's love actually infuses itself even in the human loves of affection and of friendship and of eros, of romantic love, and makes them become more what they were always intended to be. We don't have the power to believe in that. So as we see this love, then, we see it's a love that gives. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself. Ephesians 5:25. John 3:16, the best known. God so loved the world that he did what? He gave. It's a giving love. It's not theoretical. It's very real. It's very manifest. When I think about love, I think about a lot of distortions that go in the name of love. And some illustrations come to mind of different distortions of love. First one I wanted to share with you is an illustration of a lack of love. And by the way, you might well say that the opposite of love is not just hatred, it may well be indifference. You see, there can be a greater power to indifference because at least if you hate someone, you have some concern about it, you know, and that can be twisted around. That's why that famous line, there's so many from Casablanca. Sometime I'm going to do this with you. I'm going to give you little one-liners from about 100 movies and see how many of them you can identify. It's incredible. You know, frankly, my dear, and where is that from? You know it. You know, it's amazing how it's burned into your memory. Play it again, Sam. Actually, he never said that. He said, play it, Sam. We always get this idea. He said, play it again. And, but in Casablanca, this is the beginning, I think, of a beautiful friendship. A lot of great lines and so forth. But another line from that is when Rick tells the character played by Peter Lorre, something very, very significant along these lines. Peter Lorre says to Rick, he says, you despise me, don't you? And Rick says, I don't know. If I ever gave it any attention, I might. He doesn't despise him. He hasn't even thought about the guy. The guy's a cipher. He's not even there. That's worse than despising. You see, indifference is an interesting form of love. It's a totally interesting case that comes to my mind in 1928. And in Massachusetts, there was a case that came to the courts about a man who had been walking on a boat dock. And suddenly he tripped over a rope and he fell into the cold, deep water of an ocean bay. And he came up sputtering and yelling for help. And he cried out, "I can't swim." And he was obviously in trouble. His friends, however, were too far away to reach him in time. And just a few yards away, though, on another dock, was a young man who was sprawled in a deck chair. And he was sunbathing. And when he heard the desperate shout, "Help, I can't swim," he nonchalantly turned his head to the guy, looked at him, and then turned back. And then the guy went down one last time, never to be seen again. Turned out that this guy was an excellent swimmer. The family was so livid about his behavior that they brought him to court. And what's interesting about this is that this kind of display of callous indifference was what they used to sue the sunbather, and they lost. Because the court reluctantly ruled that the man in the dock had no legal responsibility to try and save the other man's life. In effect, the law agrees with Cain, "I am not my brother's keeper. And I have every right, legal right, to mind my own business and to refuse to become involved." All of us recognize that while indifference may be legal, it can be immoral. And there is this radical distinction, you see, that what we're called to is not merely to obey the laws of the land, but something higher than that. There are the laws of love. There is the law of Christ, which is a higher thing than any law of the land. So that's a form of love, of a distorted love, of the opposite of love, of indifference, where one doesn't even care. If I gave you any thought, maybe I would hate you and despise you. But then here's another form of love. So many examples of distorted love, aren't there? I bet if you can just think a little bit, you'll think of a wide variety of ways in which love can be twisted and distorted and really either given the wrong amount, the wrong object, the wrong desires, all sorts of things. Here's something that I read in The Age of Missing Information by Bill McKibben. A very good little description. He wrote, "Everyone knows about pet cemeteries, but CNN carried the story of a cemetery where people could be buried with their pets. The Fox affiliate offered news of a New York company that will freeze-dry your dead pet so that you can keep him in your living room." I'm sure a lot of you will be interested in this. A 20-pound dog will run you $1,200. We charge by the pound, but on birds, we've got a flat rate. And they take 4 months to prepare. After we got him back, we'd just put him in his normal position, and people would walk up to him, pet him, joke with him, and then notice he was dead. I just love that they noticed he was dead, said one satisfied owner. "Archie was our whole life. Everything we did was for Archie. Even though he wasn't going to be living, we could still stroke him, still tell him how much we loved him. I want to say, get a life." Sorry, Arch, but the dog was named after you, so what can I tell you? Archie was our whole life. This is kind of depressing. That's a totally distorted love, and there are people who do this. These crazy excesses that people go to, where they love actually their animals more than they love people. And this is a very common kind of experience as well. Then there's another form of love, conditional love. Besides indifference and distorted love, there's also the whole process of conditional love. And I suspect that most of us have a lot of personal experience with this one. A lot of personal experience. It's performance-based. It's perfectionistic. There are strings attached. It never is quite enough. You attain something. What have you done lately? This sort of a mindset. And that can be very, very destabilizing. A person cannot really, on the basis of that kind of love, have any security unless there's something more profound than that. And it is necessary then for us to be redefined by God if we were parented, for example, in that way. Here's a story that I picked up from a book called Quality Friendship. Let me read it to you. During the Korean War, the phone rang one day in a fashionable home on the east coast of the United States. To her astonished delight, the woman who answered found herself speaking to her son. There had been long months of silence during his absence in Korea, and now she was both startled and delighted to hear that he was in San Diego on his way home. "Mom, I just want to tell you that I'm bringing a buddy home with me. He got hurt pretty bad, and he only has one eye, one arm, and one leg. I'd sure like to have him live with us." "Sure, son," she replied. "He sounds like a brave man. We can find room for him for a while." "Mom, you don't understand. I want him to come live with us." "Well, okay," she relented. "We could try for 6 months or so." "No, Mom, I want him to stay always. He needs us. He's only got one arm, one leg, and one eye. He's really in bad shape." His mother lost patience. "Son, you're getting pretty unrealistic about this. You're being emotional because you've been in a war. That boy will be a drag on you and a problem for all of us. Be reasonable." Suddenly, the phone clicked dead. The next day, the parents received from the Navy a telegram that crushed them. The night before, their son had leaped to his death from the 12th floor of a San Diego hotel. A week later, they received the body and looked down with unspeakable horror and sorrow on the corpse of their one-eyed, one-armed, one-legged son. Conditional acceptance destroys people. You can see that. And he was testing the waters because there is always this issue. Best Years of Our Lives is a good example of a film that explores this issue with real profundity. One of the novels that I taught in my Great Book series was Steinbeck's East of Eden, the Cain and Abel story in a totally new kind of setting. But there's this profound little statement about the universal need for love that Steinbeck so aptly understood. "In uncertainty, I am certain that underneath their topmost layers of frailty, men want to be good and want to be loved. Indeed, most of their vices are attempted shortcuts to love." Let me stop there. That's a very perceptive statement. Most of our vices are attempted shortcuts to love. Most things that we call immoral and wrong are distorted loves. That's a very important thing for us to hear. He goes on to write, "When a man comes to die, no matter what his talents and influence and genius, if he dies unloved, his life must be a failure to him and his dying a cold horror. It seems to me that if you or I must choose between two courses of thought or action, we should remember our dying and try so to live that our death brings no pleasure to the world." A well-written statement, that. And that is absolutely true. It rings true because the scriptures teach us then that all of us created in the image of God were created to be agents and beings of love and relationship, because God is a relational being. It also teaches us, though, that in this fallen world, we will be tempted to pursue those needs, but in all the wrong places. We'll be tempted to manipulate people, sometimes to abuse them, sometimes trying to pull strings, all sorts of things, because we have this fundamental need which will not go away. And unless we find that need met in the right way and in the right by the right person, we will not be able to truly love in the ultimate sense of the word. Another book that comes to my mind is C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, to speak about distorted forms of love, where people are willing to go up to heaven only to get their son to go back with them to hell. It's an interesting notion there, because they can't live without him. Or in this woman's case, her husband, because you see she misses manipulating him. And he's in heaven and she's in hell, so she's, "What will I do? I need somebody to tell what to do." You know, that sort of a thing. It's a wonderful exploration of distorted need loves. It's really brilliantly done. But it's true that you can only love another person as well as you love yourself. You see, you must love your neighbor as, he says, yourself. If you have self-loathing, your capacity to be other-centered will be distorted. This is why I use the expression, love yourself correctly. Not in a narcissistic way, not in an egotistical way. No, that's not the true love. a true love, loving yourself correctly, is to see yourself as God sees you. And we've talked about this many times. To choose to believe that what God says about you is true, even though you don't feel that way, even though it doesn't comport with your experience, God has said this is true, and I will embrace that. And when I live into that truth and lean into it and learn from it, then I become more and more a person who lives out of sufficiency, not deficiency. And I see myself then as capable of expressing love because God expressed love to me. So you can only love others to the degree that you grasp God's love for you. And I think that's very critical. It was Reinhold Niebuhr who put it this way. He said, the paradox of the moral life, and this is biblical love now. We've moved away from indifference and distorted love. We've moved away from those kinds of loves that are need loves and so forth, lack of love, conditional love, all those. We now move into the territory of biblical love. Niebuhr writes, the paradox of the moral life consists in this, that the highest mutuality is achieved where mutual advantages are not consciously sought as the fruit of love. That's a very perceptive statement, you see. You're not looking to a person for mutual advantage. There may be mutual advantage coming from a relationship. Remember that God is your source of all things. He may mediate that through people, but you never look to people as your source of gain. Do you see this concept? There's an important distinction between the two. Because the minute you see another man as your source of whatever it is you're looking for, you'll be committed to manipulating them. But if you instead grasp that God is your source, and that he may or may not mediate those needs through people, then you're capable of serving and loving people regardless of the response. Even if there's no reciprocity, there's a big difference. Niebuhr goes on to write, for love is purest where it desires no returns for itself, and it is most potent where it is purest. Complete mutuality with its advantages to each party to the relationship is therefore most perfectly realized where it is not intended. But love is poured out without seeking returns. That is how the madness of religious morality with its trans-social ideal becomes the wisdom which achieves wholesome social consequences. For the same reason, a purely prudential morality must be satisfied with something less than the best. Again, a very profound insight. Or another illustration of biblical love, this through Saint Augustine. What does love look like? It has the hands to help others. It has the feet to hasten to the poor and needy. It has eyes to see misery and want. It has the ears to hear the sighs and sorrows of men. That is what love looks like. And so in looking at these and exploring these radical differences between what the world perceives as love and what the scriptures perceive as love, we begin to grasp the lie, the error, of the myth, for example, of romantic love, where we confuse romantic love with the real thing, and all those kinds of things which will not sustain a relationship very long at all. Something deeper, something more profound is required. What thoughts do you have on this? Any comments or questions or thoughts? Yes.
Several years ago, you gave us five Greek words for love or denoting love, and you gave us storge and epitaneia. My question for you is, does a lot of the distortion come out of the epitaneia and the storge more so than the other three?
Yeah, John is mentioning the five kinds of love because although Lewis mentions four, there is another love that he mentions, epithumia, which is a love of desire, sometimes translated lust, but it doesn't have to be lust. It can be a neutral thing. Epithumia is a desire for something. Turns out that that's the word that would be used when I, as a boy, remember saying to my parents or someone, I love chocolate. They said, you can't love chocolate. But I did love chocolate, you see. And I never could figure out, why can't you love chocolate? Of course, you can't agape chocolate. You can't storge the love of affection. That's a relational love. You can't phileo chocolate. Chocolate's not my buddy unless I'm really nuts. You know, I can't have a romantic love. Well, I suppose you can. There are some kinky people with chocolate. But at the end of the day, I still said I could love chocolate. I epithumiaed chocolate. I had a desire for it. You see the concept there? So each word in the Greek is rich. It's a richer language in many respects because it has a greater wealth of words for some important themes like this. Storge is the love of affection. And that, like every other love, can have its own downfalls. The love of affection can be distorted to where you take people for granted, for example. Then there's the love of phileo, which is of friendship, which can again be distorted in its manifestations and become a kind of a thing, we versus them. Then there's the love of eros, which is not always merely the sexual. That's what Lewis calls Venus, but there is another dimension, which is romantic love. And romantic love can be a very powerful thing, but once again, it's not enough to sustain itself. And then after eros, of course, the agape. But the point is, all of the four human loves can be and are. If they can be, they are distorted. But they can also be redeemed. Remember how I said when we spoke about money, sex, and power that none of those things are neutral? That all of them have a downward gravity? But that even so, they can all be used and leveraged for a greater good if you use them properly and see them for what they are. You can actually leverage those things for eternal good. So it depends not on the thing, but how you use it that makes the difference. Yes, Lewis.
I'm struck by how inadequate our language is to talk about this, because, you know, I agree more with Shakespeare. Love is not love, but by the move or move, it doesn't ever fix it.
Yeah, you were saying a counterfeit Monet is describing something with deficiency. And by the way, we counterfeit stuff that's valuable, not junk. What's the good in counterfeiting kitsch? You see, I remember those hideous Keane paintings in the 50s and 60s with these giant eyes. I mean, why would I want to counterfeit that? You know, maybe some of you like those things. Maybe I'm... Maybe they bring a lot of money on eBay. I have no idea. But, of course, H.L. Mencken was right. Nobody ever went broke underestimating the taste of the American people. But having said that, though, there are some things that are really worthwhile. Jewelry and great art and a wide variety of things that can be counterfeited and will be. But as you say, the limit is their distortion. They're not able to realize the very real thing. Here God gives us an opportunity to have a love that is, in fact, divine in its origin and its power. So it not only comes from God, but it comes through God. You see the issue there? The agape of God is not only from Him, but through Him. And that is unique again. We're not trying to manufacture something that's impossible of human attainment, but rather, we become receptacles who display that which we could ourselves never create. We don't create anything. We receive and display. So there's an enormous difference. Another comment or question or thought?
This type of love, perfect love, that God calls the cast off fear, will as a verb.
He's quoting from 1 John 4, I think it's 18, that perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves punishment, and the one who fears is not perfected in love. And he's then asking, is that the kind of fear that's overcome by an act of the will? Is that what you're suggesting there? Because the fear that John is talking about, by the way, is not the fear of God, but the fear of condemnation. And that's what religion, again, is all about. Always worrying about condemnation, whether I've made enough or earned enough or done enough or given enough or whatever it is to please God. That's the religion trap. You stop doing that. It's impossible of attainment. But I believe that this love of God is indeed a love of the will, and it is a love that chooses to embrace be embraced by him and then to embrace others with that with which I was embraced. And in so doing, then, it is not a love of fear, but it is a love instead of aspiration for the highest good of others, and so that it is a fulfillment of the loving of God first, the first great commandment, and the loving of my neighbor as myself. And think about the essence of life being encapsulated in those two great commandments, loving God and loving others. It's astoundingly simple, yet boundlessly profound. And so we put these truths together, and again, I revel in the uniqueness of this vision that God has for us. Any other thoughts or questions? Because we are about to quit a little bit early. Yes.
Well, if perfect love casts out all fear, is it a sin to fear?
Be anxious for nothing, but in everything with prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your request be made known to God. If we define fear as anxiety, yes.
Because that's not trusting God.
It's not trusting God. He says, be anxious for a few things. No, he didn't say that. For nothing. Now, it doesn't mean you can't have concerns for various things, but when you allow anxiety to come upon you, what's now happening is you've taken a burden back that you should have been given to God. We have a way of doing that. We may give it back to God and have the peace of God which surpasses all comprehension. Remember that? But then we'll take it back again. And that's why virtually every day we have to let loose of these burdens and ask Him to carry them, because we are not big enough that He can sustain that. So, and by the way, I may say fear, that form of thing, anxiety, that worry, not only is it unbiblical, because it questions whether God has our best interests at heart and is in control, but secondly, it's totally unproductive. Because here now, you can fret and worry and be anxious about something, and that will not solve the problem at all, you see. In fact, you've only made it worse. Most of what we worry about will not happen. And of those few things that do happen, you only made it worse by worrying about it first and then it happening. You see. With that, last thought here. Yeah.
I'm going to say in John 14:15, Jesus calls us to...
If you love me, keep my commandments.
We find fulfillment in that as we live a life that is filled with confession, which recognizes our deficiencies.
And that's right, because we have to confess and acknowledge and be brutally honest about the fact that we fall short and we cannot do it, but then we return back to Him. It's been described in this way. The spiritual life is like a combination of two statements. Thou art the man, and thou art my God. You catch the two? One is that of conviction, Nathan's thou art the man, but then the realization that you are my God, and I will turn to you and ask you to do through me what I could never do for myself. I don't have the power to keep His commands on my own power. It's a divine-human process. It's not merely human. It transcends human attainment.
Thank you for listening to this talk, which is part of a series of messages by Dr. Ken Boa. To order additional talks on CD or MP3, or to learn about any of Dr. Boa's other Bible-based teachings, go to our web ministry at kenboa.org. That's kenboa.org. Or call 1-800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 1-800-372-9632.